listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
That was a story that was also true. There was a lot truer than the truth that I put down.
I saw what would look like these little dudes from like Monsters, Inc. movie, and they were kind of like knocking on my brain, opening it up a little bit, like peeking in, knocking on my brain, peeking in, knocking on my brain, peeking in.
As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast. This is Kevin Sullivan, as always, and with me tonight.
Greetings. This is Savannah, as always.
Have you been working on that?
All day.
She's like, greetings. This is Savannah. Records it, checks different angles. you got to have like your little, what is that? Your intro.
Yeah, my thing. I got to have my thing. I got to figure out what that is. Yeah.
And then when your fans see you on the street, they can be like, say it. Do it into my phone. Because that's what happens to me all the time. It's tough, but you know, you got to do what the fans want you to do. I kid. Anyways, tonight's episode is pretty cool. I think it, from researching John, I think it's going to be a different take on near-death experiences, but it'll be that near-death experience nonetheless. And, you know, just as we interviewed a bunch of different people on AI and stuff, and each person had their own perspective on it, mm-hmm. I think he will bring up his own perspective. We're getting a little feedback. Who's that?
It's not me. I'm on an airplane.
With us tonight is John Mathis. He is author of The Alchemist's Heir. And if you want to read about it or look it up, it's on Amazon, I think. Am I right, John?
Yep, it's on Amazon.
Okay. And you can go to his website, Alchemists. Remember the S, because I tried to do without the S, mm-hmm. And I didn't get to your website. But it's Alchemist's Heir, H-E-I-R, .com. So his book is described as... distilled in Reiki. Am I saying that right? Reiki.
Yeah.
Reiki.
Well, okay. I don't know why I just answered. That's
well, I mean, you can answer too, I guess.
I think I know what that is. I think it's pronounced Reiki.
Okay.
You got it. You got
all right.
It.
Guided meditation, spiritualism, Silva method, and comparative religions and sacred geometry. So two things in there I'm really, really interested in. And just recently it's been sacred geometry, and we'll get into that a little bit later. I think I sent you a question on that, John. And then comparative religions, because mm-hmm. I just find those to be fascinating. Additionally, he is a fellow scientist.
Yeah, I've been doing pharma research for about 20 years.
There you go.
And most recently working with IBM Watson Healthcare.
I know.
No
that's
way.
Yeah, that's really cool. I texted you before this, John, and I was like, I wish you didn't tell me that because of the obsession that I guess both myself and Savannah have on Watson and all that. We're never going to get into our subject, but it's okay. If this becomes an episode on Watson, I'll be fine with that, believe it or not.
Actually, this is Watson speaking to you now.
No shit. Wow. He's getting really good. Do you think that at some point, no kidding, that's what AI is going to sound like?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like the conversation that we're having right now.
Oh, yeah.
The different inflections in your voice, the pausing, things like that.
Absolutely.
Wow. How far down the pipeline do you think it is?
I can't tell you.
4 years. All right. John Mathis says 4 years. We will have. I want to start with this quote right here. The brain itself does not produce consciousness, that it is instead a kind of reducing valve or filter, shifting the larger non-physical consciousness that we possess in the non-physical worlds down to a more limited capacity for duration of our mortal lives. And that was by Eben Alexander, Proof of Heaven. He was a neurosurgeon. What are your thoughts on that? That, you know, rather than the brain being a conscious machine, some say it's more of a, like a TV set that's receiving a signal, and consciousness basically looks for an outlet versus it's created by an outlet.
Yeah, I think consciousness is something separate from the whole body, not just the brain.
Okay.
And I think our cells can tap into that. The brain is a convenient analog. And I think maybe either the cells or the brain is a reduction valve, so to speak, because, I mean, if we could all manifest as we just have random thoughts in our head, I mean, the world would look like an Escher drawing and a Jackson Pollock painting all at the same time. I mean, we 40 would be empty on Friday afternoons because everyone would be trying to kill each other, trying to get home, and we would just vaporize everybody.
How so? Explain that a little bit more.
I think that our consciousness has the ability to manifest things in reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that we have to have a reduction valve on that because so many people have so many scattered thoughts. I don't know if you've heard the term monkey mind, mm-hmm. but we just squirrel.
Yeah.
we just have these thoughts that just randomly shoot through our head every once in a while, or, you know, we act in the moment and we're upset about something and we think thoughts that we don't act on. We just think them and then they pass through us. Mm-hmm. And if we're manifesting everything that we think, it just would be chaos.
Right. So almost like, I don't know, static. There'd be so much static out there. Do you think it would be possible to get like a group of people to be able to manifest a thought, basically manifest a... I don't even know, like an action or...
Yeah. I mean, to actually get something tangible to occur just with their thoughts.
Absolutely. I've participated in non-scientific and scientific approaches to that very same paradigm. That's kind of where Silva method caught my attention, because there were papers written back in the 70s where... Jose Silva was a TV repairman, but he had these really interesting ideas on how to use hypnosis to implant ideas and suggestions. And he was working with his kids because they were Mexican Americans and English was not their first language. And he wanted to give his kids a leg up. So he would read through their textbooks while they were under hypnosis so that they would have the answers available to them when they got tested. And a curious thing happened is that before he would verbally ask the question, they would give him the answer.
Wow.
Really?
So he then took that and met with another gentleman who is a psychologist named George DeSaw. And between the two of them, they start coming up with some really interesting ideas, and one of them was to go into a school in downtown Philly. The graduation rate was somewhere around, I think, 60-70%, and they taught these kids how to create their own triggers so that they could go and do the same thing that his kids were doing, that Silva's kids were doing. Within 2 years, the graduation rate was around 98%. Mm. And even after the experiment stopped, the school kept doing some of these techniques. And they continued to have a 90% graduation rate for several years.
Can you describe the techniques? What exactly were they doing?
So, for example, they do this one technique where if you were to... pinch your two fingers and your thumb together like you're playing castanets. But you would hold those fingers together and say, okay, while I have my fingers in this position, I'm going to remember everything that I'm about to hear. And then they would read through the notes that were going to be on the test. And so then when they went into the classroom, they would do this little finger technique and then kind of like state-dependent learning. It would then allow that information to be available to them.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, that actually kind of makes sense to me.
Why isn't it more widespread? You know what I mean? Like with the state of education right now, how come that hasn't been adopted, say, through the Department of Education, and now everyone, you know what I mean? Are people skeptic of it? Are they wary of it?
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, there's plenty of research out there. Another thing that they did is they noticed that in Washington, D.C., when the temperature got above a certain point, that violence increased. So what they did is they got, 15, 20 people. I don't remember the exact number, but I would say it's probably less than 30. But they had all these people meditate and say, okay, when the temperature gets to a certain point or above a certain point in D.C., we want everyone to feel a sense of calm and relaxation. And sure enough, there was a temperature spike and the violence rate was flat.
I wonder, that's interesting. A research article that I would like to read. I'd like to read more about that. But I mean, where can I find that? I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
Google. Yeah, no problem. Right. Google is a place to start. Silva.org.
Yeah.
Silva went through several different names. During the 70s, they called themselves Silva Mind Control. But then MK Ultra came to light. And they decided maybe mind control is not a good thing to call this. So then it became Silva Mind Method. Then it became Silva Method. And now it's just Silva Technique. But if you go into Silva, they have different ways to use your mind in a way that, either improves your learning, improves memory, recall, health. Again, you don't remain a passenger in your body. You gain control and you deliberately use your consciousness in a way to manifest a better way of living.
Wow. So this actually will bring us into our next topic and our main topic. So the brain is a lot more powerful than we give it credit for. I think the classical thought is, like we said earlier, it's a machine and it brings rise to consciousness. I'm a skeptic at heart, only because I like to see things and I like to experience things for myself. But I am really moving towards the metaphysical side of things, just with this podcast, just from talking to people and hearing different sides of different stories about how people have tapped into their, I guess, mind power and have made changes and. Mm-hmm. So, but with that, I want to read a passage from your site, John, and we'll talk about, what happened after that. So from your site, I was in a void of blackness where my consciousness was no longer tethered to my body. Having experimented several times with astral projection, I had a sensation of movement, of flying without wind or friction. This was different. In this void, there was only my consciousness exercising I have a trouble. It's like a going thing on this podcast. John, I have my master's degree and everything, but I cannot read out loud for the life of me. It's like this thing. My brain gets ahead of myself and then I just stumble over the word. I used to have to give briefings in the Air Force in front of a room of like 50 officers, and it was just awful. I had to memorize it because I could never read up in front of people. But
you just put your fingers together like casting up.
That's what I'll do. And not to mention I'm wearing braces now or my Invisalign, which is also gets stuck in the way and whatever. So let's go back to that. exercising understatement. I thought to myself, this is interesting.
Okay. Wow. What a lead in.
Yeah, it took a while.
Well, there's really two ways to look at this. I mean, do you want to look at it from a clinical perspective or do you want to look at it from a metaphysical perspective?
Well, I want to look at it as an experience perspective. I want to know, what you experienced, how you felt. And then again, we'll go into how you actually found yourself there and what it's done to your life or what it's meant for your life.
Well, so part of what I was saying earlier was that I had done some remote viewing and astral projection prior to my near-death experience. So I was already accustomed to, before I even had my driver's license, I was doing projection. So I could go places and see things and be aware of things that were going, like in my friends' homes or at my cousins or, you know, my grandparents. And so when I had my near-death experience, it wasn't like I was still wearing my meat suit.
Okay.
And when you do projection, it's like if I'm in a room and I'm meditating, I'm aware of my room. I'm aware of the temperature and, you know, the fan that's running or whatever. And then when I say I want to go someplace, then I'm there immediately and I see everything that's in that surrounding. Mm-hmm. The near-death experience was in a place of just pure white.
So rather than traveling within this universe, you traveled within another realm.
Yes, we'll call it another realm because I really don't know what it was. I can just tell you it was different.
Before we get to, can you explain what astral projection is? Because I actually have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So if you can imagine consciousness as a ladder, and just kind of a sidebar, what type of PA? Well, what area do you work in? Are you cardiovascular, or do you do anything with anesthesia, or
no, family medicine?
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you talk to an anesthesiologist, they'll tell you that consciousness is like a ladder and you can keep putting people further and further down. And so like when you're lightly asleep, you're kind of in that dream state, but you're also aware that, you know, the clock's ticking or the dog wants to be fed or your partner's next to you.
Right.
That's what I would call like a remote viewing. My consciousness is both aware of what's local and non-local. And when you do remote viewing, you have a handler who says, okay, I want you to go to this place, or I want you to go to these coordinates. And so they kind of walk you through what you're supposed to be seeing. And then you answer back, you know, they say, you know, go to this place. What do you see? And you verbally tell them in the room what you're seeing.
If I can interrupt you for a second. So the experience of projecting yourself, did you say that's like being almost in a dream state where you're aware of your surroundings the state you're in prior to projecting?
That is projecting.
Okay.
So you have a level of consciousness where your brain waves are kind of in beta.
Okay.
So you're processing, you're thinking, you're talking to the phone, you're writing checks, whatever.
Yeah.
When you go into an alpha state, you're kind of that light, sleepy, dreamy state. You're getting close to kind of a delta state, a really low brain cycles. And at that point, that's when you can start doing the first step, which what I would call remote viewing, because you're both conscious of your surroundings as well as where you're going. And you can interact with your handler. That's remote viewing. The next step down is what I would call astral projection, because now you're no longer aware of your surroundings. I no longer hear the fan in the room. I no longer am aware that I'm lying in bed. I am now, for all intents and purposes, at that location.
Hmm. So that's an amazing capability, and a lot of people, I think, would want to be able to do that. Why do you think that you have this capability?
Because no one told me I couldn't do it.
Hmm. So how long, I mean, so this is something you've been able to do since a very young age, presumably?
Yeah, at 14 years old, I was actually out riding my bike and I came across a garage sale. And so I stopped in and I bought a box of books for $3. And inside this box of books was a book on astral projection called Far Journeys by Robert Monroe. And so I read it and I kind of thought it was fiction because this guy was talking about how he was projecting places and things. And I thought, oh, cool. Let me see if I can do that. And the first couple of times I just fell right to sleep. So I started setting an alarm, you know, for 10, 15 minutes. And eventually I got to that place where I learned where I'm in that dream state. And now I can start going places. It's almost like, directing your own dreams. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I wanted to know what my friends were doing. I wanted to know what grandma and grandpa were doing. And so I set that intention. And then all of a sudden, one day, boom, there I was.
Were your experiences ever validated? Which I guess sounds like a general question. But I mean, like confirmed when you went somewhere and saw something that it was impossible for you to know unless you had projected.
Yeah. So the first couple of times I did it, I was doing things like I hopped into my friend's room to see what he was doing. And as I was wandering around his house, I discovered that he was actually hiding something. And so I like, oh, what are you hiding? Well, he was hiding one of his dad's Playboys. So I called him out on that. And he's like, oh, well, my brother must have told you or someone must have told you. And it wasn't until I got into college and was around a crowd of people who, one, I didn't have a former relationship with, or two, their homes were hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And it was like that night I say, hey, I'll go to your house. I'll tell you something cool about your house. Well, I couldn't make a 900-mile round trip overnight. Mm-hmm. And so the next morning I came back and said, hey, your basement looks like this and you've got a hole in your wall and your dad has movies back there and you remove this little plaque from the hole in the wall and you shoot movies. And, you know, their mouths drop open like a Pez dispenser.
Man, you know what? Now that you say that, I wish I had you project yourself to my house before we did this podcast, because that would have been wild.
Yeah, I'm a little rusty at that, but I just had a guy about a year ago. I talked him into going to something at the are you familiar with the Rhine Research Institute here in Durham?
Yep, we actually had a podcast last year at the Psy Games.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. So this guy's from France, and I invited him to the Psy Games. And I told him what to expect. And then he asked me, well, can you do that? And I said, yeah, I'm a little rusty, but yeah, I can do that. And he said, well, let me set up a target in my apartment and you tell me what it is. I'm like, okay, sure. And so he was kind of on the fence on going to this Psy Games to begin with. But he set up the target and I went and looked and I came, came back and then I emailed him. I said, okay, so I'm rusty, but that's my disclaimer, but here I go. So I found your target. Your target had something to do with air, and it wasn't solid, like it wasn't metal or steel or rock. I said it was very wispy. It was very fine. And the thing that was unusual about it is that it had stars in it as well. And I saw these really brilliant white stars on a dark background. But again, I can't say this enough, that wind or breeze or airiness, it has something to do with that. And he said, okay, well, is that all you got? I said, yeah, that's all I got, dude. He said, well, it was an American flag.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty spot on.
So one of the things they tell you in remote viewing is that as soon as you decide it's a something, then the ability for you to draw more details stops.
Right.
Because your brain becomes satisfied.
Right. So you just go by like, and we did this when we were at the Psy Games last year. I remember what he told us is, you know, if you kind of draw what your brain is thinking, how do I put it? He had us basically draw before we had a chance to think about what we were drawing, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. So like always mm-hmm. staying kind of behind your consciousness, kind of let things come out and then look at it afterwards and say, oh, okay.
Is it like when you see a very bright star, but when you actually look straight at it, it gets a lot more dim? When you're looking away, it's much more clear.
No, that's macular degeneration. you're screwed.
Do you think that, sorry, what were you saying?
I said, as soon as you get a detail, you note the detail, and then you say, what's next? You don't mm-hmm. give your brain the opportunity to say it's a certain thing.
Okay.
So you say you're rusty. Presumably that's because you just aren't really interested in astral projecting as much anymore?
Correct. I've found more interesting things to do.
like Speak with God, which we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah.
You know, just the creator of everything. And I thought you said something interesting too. You said no one ever told you you couldn't do it. And it brought back a memory I had with a guy, and I, for life, I can't think of his name, but it was a podcast last year. I think you were here at Savannah for it. He was a holistic medical person, but he was very much into ayahuasca and DMT. And I asked him why he thinks it's illegal. And he was like, because if everyone was free, you know, and that's what he had mentioned, that when he experienced DMT, when he experienced ayahuasca, he was no longer held down with, you know, I guess his earthly desires. He quit his job and he went off to something completely new. And he said, if everyone had that opportunity, the world would fall apart because no one would be doing any of the work. And I was thinking, and maybe I'm going a little conspiracy here, but are we conditioned to not think metaphysically and not think beyond what we can actually do here in the physical world just so we're corralled?
There are very few things in my mind that I hold as 100% true. And that's one of them.
Wow.
And I don't think that it's necessarily something to be, I don't think it's a conspiracy theory. I think that we are indoctrinated from birth. I mean, you have family expectations, and then that family then sets forth societal, sometimes a religious template that's superimposed over that. And then if you start watching TV and the people you hang out with, they all condition you to behave a certain way. And until you realize that your consciousness is separate from your meat suit, and until you realize that those societal expectations are choices and not obligations, then you don't even know you're trapped.
Mm-hmm. Profound way to think of it.
But between astral projection and ghost hunting and doing Reiki, all of that was going on in my life prior to my near-death experience. And then after that, it's like I said, all that stuff got thrown into a blender, and I no longer thought of each one of these things as silos. It all got connected. And then I realized that what an interesting video game this life is.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some that actually think that it is simulation theory. Yeah. Which it could be, you never know.
Yeah. Elon Musk was just in the news saying that this might be a simulation.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that think that, I don't know. There's no way to prove it. So I just rack it up to, all right, another one of those things. It's like the multiverse. I mean, there's really no way to prove there's a multiverse. So it's a neat idea, but I mean, at this point, it means nothing to me until I actually have the ability to, I guess, see it or move past it. So
let me ask you a question about consciousness.
Sure.
Have you heard anything about cell memory? Like, for example, when a lady who was probably in her late 30s, early 40s, she had a heart-lung transplant. Mm-hmm. She was a lesbian. And after her transplant, she became heterosexual. Mm-hmm. She was vegan. And when she was, quote unquote, healed, she had this huge craving for two things, video games and chicken McNuggets. And it turns out later she found out who her donor was, and her donor was a 19-year-old teenage boy.
Wow.
And when she talked to the family, it was like that's all the boy would eat.
See, that's amazing. And have I heard? Yeah, I've heard of it, I guess, through anecdotal evidence, you know, through stories and things like that. I don't know if people are discussing it.
I think that's been documented.
In medical literature?
Well,
it's out there.
Yeah.
I mean, there's been recently actually some stories about that, which is just mind blowing.
It's fascinating.
Yeah. If you start on Google and pull things up, mm-hmm. then flip over to scholar.google.
Okay.
Yeah. And use the same search criteria, and then you'll start bringing up the peer-reviewed literature about these things, and you'll find out what's anecdotal and what's actually been studied.
Wow, I'm going to have to look that up, because that's cool. Joe Rogan talks a lot about how, and there's some thought, I guess, within the science community, too, about cell memory and passing those memories on to your children, or passing on say traumatic experiences to your children or skills. So basically my progeny will have inherently, like, so things that I experienced being a combat veteran, that they could build up defense mechanisms based on that, even though they weren't there, but it's passed through the memory of my DNA and my cells. Ever hear that?
I have. John, what are your thoughts on that?
I can't think of the new school of science now that basically is saying that, because it used to be nature versus nurture.
Right.
And that when I went through nursing school, one of the things that was told me was that your genetics loads the gun, but your environment pulls the trigger. Mm-hmm. And then that's how you develop diabetes or heart disease or whatever. But I've also seen this recent, again, the name is escaping me. But the school of science now where they're saying there's actually memories within your genetic structure. Mm-hmm. There's actually a video game and also a movie out, Assassin's Creed, that builds the entire storyline on that concept of genetic memory and being able to down the line, you know, four or five generations later, some memory or some talent comes through. And some people say, you know, oh, well, you're a singer. You must have had a family that was a good singer, or you're a good carpenter. Oh, your grandfather was a carpenter. You know, which is it, nature or nurture? And I think that that's a pretty narrow perspective.
And part of the reason I asked what you thought about that was I've recently worked with a life coach, and one of the things she did was sort of energy work. It wasn't Reiki, but she talks about this very phenomenon where she said that you can actually inherit strange trapped emotions from your grandparents, from their experiences. And even though that sounds completely baloney to, you know, skeptic Savannah, I don't see any harm in trying to release some of that if she can help me with it. So I thought maybe Reiki, your experience with Reiki might have also kind of been similar, but it's probably not something you do with Reiki,
well,
I guess.
Reiki is just one type of energetic medicine. And I kind of went to Reiki because it did not have a religious overtone. The other thing is that I was doing it without knowing what I was doing, and someone caught me at it. So before I got into nursing school, I was actually, doing a patient transport in a hospital, and I was transferring a patient to the, physical therapy gym, the torture chamber. Yeah. And while I was working on them, my hands got really hot. And I broke out in a sweat, and the lady actually complained. It wasn't just, wow, your hands are really warm. She's like, ow, wow, your hands are hot. And I was like, yeah, well, I've been moving patients around, and, you know, that was my explanation. But the therapist who was taking notes over in the corner, she came over and she goes, let me see your hands. And so I pulled my hands out, and they were just red, like 20 degrees below zero, or I'd been clapping for an hour, but they were bright, bright red. And she's like, you know Reiki. What? And I said, who's Reiki?
So how, like, what made that happen? Were you thinking about something, or what made you, I guess, manifest that energy?
So before I had the Reiki template, I would just put my hands on patients to help them with their exercises in, okay, you know, in the gym. But as I was doing that, I was counting with my eyes closed. But while I was doing that, all of a sudden I would get imagery. And that's where the sacred geometry came in, because I got all these weird symbols and things. 90% of it I didn't recognize. I just thought, huh, I wonder what that is. And so I started drawing these things as I discovered them. And then it was probably close to a decade later that I saw some of these symbols and I was like, oh, what's that? And it was a book about sacred geometry. And so then I flipped through, I'm sitting at a Barnes and Noble flipping through this, like, oh my God, I saw that. And a couple of pages later, oh my God, I saw that too.
Hmm. Have you ever done DMT?
I have not. The strongest drug I've ever done is marijuana. And when you mentioned DMT, it was like, I know it from just reading some Graham Hancock. Mm-hmm. And ayahuasca is definitely on my bucket list. I'd like to, you know, I've done all this stuff kind of organically, and it would be interesting to see what would happen if I gave it a push.
Sure. And I think it's an important thing in society. I mean, it's illegal, and I think it's ridiculous because it's not like people are going out and drinking ayahuasca tea and then shitting themselves and puking everywhere for fun. You know what I mean? It's not a recreational thing. It's an experience. And
right.
What's amazing about it and is the commonality, like the things that you would see, these sacred geometric shapes coincide with other people see at the same time. And trips, whether you're on a DMT trip in Alaska or in the jungles of South America, you have the same benevolence, that presence that's with you. You often have conversations with what people describe as aliens, you know, people from another world that I think Graham Hancock said it like, they said, ah, we're so glad you found this technology to talk with us. Let's get started.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy.
Go ahead.
I've read that in two or three different books, because when I came back from my near-death experience, a lot of the near-death experiencers, when they come back, about half of them have their marching orders. And the other half come back, and as my dad used to say, their ass and their head is not wired together.
Well,
I was that guy.
Oh, really?
And so I was trying to figure out, how do I get back to that place? Yeah, because I mean, once you're over there, you're not attached to your meat suit. So any, you know, that itch doesn't bother you, that, you know, chronic ankle pain doesn't bother you, the arthritis, all of those things that are associated with your five senses is disconnected. And so the only thing left is consciousness. And for me, once I connected to source, then not only was it omnipotence, but it was also bliss, rapture. I mean, I truly had a definition for rapture at that point. And so to then come back and be compressed into this icky, sticky meat suit and try to figure out, how do I move in this world where people are mean and cruel and lie? That's why there's so many people that go through that shift where they quit their job, and loss of job, loss of their marriage, loss of religion or change of religion. Those things are inherent in almost every near-death experience.
They're also inherent in DMT trips too.
Right. And that's where I was going to go with that, because a near-death experience is just one more on-ramp to the metaphysical highway.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the near-death experience, or you do pharmacodynamics, or some people it's through fasting, other people it's through meditation or prayer. There are so many different ways that if you realize that you can separate your physical reality from your conscious reality, once you discover that, then you don't need the DMT, you don't need the ayahuasca, it's almost like muscle memory. If you do it and practice it enough, then you could just make it happen.
Wow. So take us back there. You were sick, you were in the hospital, and you were circling the drain, as we say in medicine. And then you willed yourself, right? You willed yourself into a near-death experience.
Yeah. So the clinical side of it, just real quick, I was in a weed out class for nursing school. There was like 400 applicants and only 30 slots. So it's like, well, go take advanced chemistry, advanced ANP. And if you can make it through those classes, then we'll see what happens. So during that time frame, I was taking that class. I was working a full-time job and also a part-time job. And burned the candles at both ends. I got pneumonia. I thought I could just muscle through it, and I didn't. So I was feeling really crappy, went to a doc in the box. They said, not only are you 102 degrees Fahrenheit, but you got white out in all five lobes. So yeah. The next day I presented to the emergency room. My oxygen sat was 64. Wow. At 90 is usually when they want to put you on a nasal cannula or put you on some oxygen.
Yeah, I've never seen anyone at 64.
Yeah, at 64, I shouldn't have been conscious. And I don't remember driving there, but I remember parking the car. I don't remember presenting to remember. Then my next memory from parking the car was I'm sitting in the ER. A doctor is looking at me very concerned, and my wife is sitting next to me. And at that point, I just signed the document, and I looked at my wife. I said, I'm sorry. And that's the last thing I remember. And then 13 days flew by. But what happened was I had white out in all five lobes. I had ARDS, acquired respiratory distress syndrome. Mm-hmm. So my lungs went into shock. They started flooding.
Can I pause
the lung tissue?
Just one moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think the listeners know what white out in all five lobes means.
Your lungs are filled with fluid and pus and all that bad stuff. So you're
yep.
your body's unable to process oxygen. You're dying. That's what it means.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, you have two lungs, but you have three lobes on one side and three sacs on one side and two sacs on the other. And so my lungs were completely filled with fluid. Mm-hmm. And that's why my oxygen saturation was so low, is that there was no exchange between carbon dioxide and oxygen. Mm-hmm. So they intubated me. They put me on a breathing machine. And when people get ARDS, there's about a 50 to 60% mortality rate. Because for some reason, when one major organ system shuts down in the body, mm-hmm. there's a message sent and the other major organ systems shut down. So my lungs shut down. A couple days later, my kidneys shut down. And then a couple days later, my heart tried to shut down. And at that point, I was both aware of my situation and not. They say when you're in a coma that sometimes people can hear what's going on. I was seeing what was going on. I kind of hovered above my bed, and I could follow people almost to the nurse's station, but not quite. I always had to stay around my body for some reason. But I heard people saying, circling the drain. I heard people say, last rites. I heard people say, do they have all the contacts on file? And having worked in the, you know, hospital system, I knew, wow, I must be bad, but I don't feel bad. Hmm. But some reason I came back out of that. First thing, I had a heart defect that was previously unknown. So when my heart tried to fail, I had this little battery called an SV node. And behind that was an even smaller battery, which should not exist because you only have an AV and an SA node, mm-hmm. two batteries, one that pumps the top and one that pumps the bottom. And when the bottom shuts down, you're toast. So my bottom shut down, but then this little bitty cluster said, hey, it's my time to shine. And so I had a ventricular rate of about 30 beats.
Eef, yeah, that's not good either.
So that basically stopped the cascade, because then a couple of days later, my kidneys came back online. And then a couple of days later, they did a challenge on the sedation. And on the third challenge, I was able to come up and stay out of it.
Wow.
While I was in my first day of ICU, or my first day of being extubated or having the breathing machine removed, I'm lying there and I thought, you know what? This is as close to death as I could have gotten without actually tripping over the threshold. And I was kind of pissed off, actually, because it's like, of all the astral projection I've done and all the guides I work with and all the people on the other side when I'm doing Reiki or doing other work, why didn't they step up to the plate? Why didn't I have that near-death experience? And I was kind of bummed out by it. Sure. The next thing was, boom, there I was. I was going through the tunnel and seeing the bright light at the end, and went to the light. In this white space, I saw a really brighter speck. And because there was nothing to judge distance, I didn't know if it was a teeny tiny speck right in front of my nose or a sun millions of miles away. And so in my mind, I thought, I want to know what that is. What is that? And immediately I was right there. And in the presence of just supreme knowledge and also supreme wisdom, because knowledge and wisdom are two different things. And while I was there, I was like, wow, what's this? What are you? And the response I got in my head was, I'm everything. I'm like, okay. And then as I'm trying to process that, the next wave that came over me was Cheeky Monkey. It was like this leprechaun energy. It was a mischievous kind of rapscallion energy. And immediately my brain went to the image of George Carlin. Because in my mind, George Carlin was all of those things. And yeah. So instead of seeing God or seeing Buddha or angels or Kuan Yin or whatever, I saw George Carlin.
See, that's pretty cool. I wouldn't mind George Carlin being God.
Dude, that would explain a lot of crazy shit going on here.
It really would.
So George gave me a tour, and, you know, he started explaining things and just kind of slowly started peeling back the layers. You know, here's your connection to your family, and then here's how that connection extends out to those other folks that you meet that aren't family. So it's like all of my patients, all of the people that I've met while I was teaching or in school, or, you know, some guy helped change his tire on the side of the road. I mean, all these things were revealed, and it's like, oh, okay, I see. I'm connected to everything. It was, you know, kind of like It's a Wonderful Life type thing. I get it. And as soon as I said, I get it, then it was overload. There was this huge, like, sphere. If you look at it, if I try to draw it two-dimensionally, it looks like the most ornate snowflake you've ever seen. But in three dimensions, it's almost like a ball of crystalline energy. And then I realized that I'm connected not just to people, I'm connected to things. I'm connected to rocks and trees and plant life. And so then I start exploring all these different things. And then I discovered that not only can I go to every place on the earth, but I can go off the earth. And so then I explored other planets and things that were on other planets, which correlates to some of my astral projection experiences. So then it was like, okay, what else? And then that's when it was like a magnesium flare went off in my face. And that's when I saw it's all energy. We're all connected. And all these other things that I thought were real or permanent or constrictions of our universe as it's defined by Newtonian physics is an illusion. And they're necessary illusions in order for us to play the role that we are here on this earth. It's like if you're going to put on a play, you need to have a stage, you need to have a spotlight, you need to have other lights, you need to have a follow spot, you need to have sound, you need to have a mixing board, you need to have other actors, you need to have sets, you need to have other things. And in order for us to play out this video game comic opera that is life, we need to all agree to have certain parameters in order to move forward with the experiment.
Go ahead.
And then you came back.
And all that's not DMT induced.
Yeah, right. Now it makes me tonight I'm going to. Well, I was I cut it out of the last podcast when we were chatting. I had this weird experience, and I'll probably cut it out of this one too because I can't describe it that well. But I woke up in the middle of the night. I couldn't sleep. And I went and I used the bathroom, and then again, I don't know how to put this into words, but I came back and you ever just, I like splash water on my face. And I'm looking at myself in the mirror and I just start staring at myself for whatever reason. And I got this, I started thinking, right? So I looked at my reflection, and looking at it, I tried to, so we see our reflection all the time. We don't think about it really. It's just our reflection. But for a moment, I focused on the fact that I am looking at myself from the viewpoint of another person. So then I looked into my eyes and I said, so I'm basically, I'm looking into my soul. Like I'm seeing what it looks like from the outside looking in. And then I started getting like really this uncomfortable feeling, almost like I can't really explain it. It was a really weird, uncomfortable feeling. And then I just was like, whoop, done with this. And I went to bed and then I couldn't sleep much longer. But I think I was putting myself into a weird state like that. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. Oh yeah. It's kind of like it's kind of like a threesome. You don't know what you're doing until you get into it. And then right when you're at the edge, you're like, maybe I don't want to do that. And you go back.
Maybe that's
it's kind of weird. It's kind of weird for me because I mean, I've been doing this stuff since I was 14 years old. So it, to me, it's just, you know, I'm going to go wash the dishes, do laundry and, you know, let me project into tomorrow because there's a meeting and I want to know what everyone's going to be thinking and doing so I can have an edge.
Huh? See, I that's just far out. And I just am wondering why no one else does that. Why can't, I mean, do you have a group of people that can do this, that, like, I don't know, not like a support group, but like, a group of people that know how to tap into them, this aspect of their consciousness.
Yeah. I mean, the Rhine has got different classes throughout the week that you can go into, or if you go into the Rhine and say, hey, I've got this going on, there's some groups that meet that aren't on the radar, so to speak, that are also going on there. And I mean, because I went into them and I said, I think I've broke my brain. And the lady, she's like, okay. And I said, well, let me just say this and then you tell me if I've broken my brain. I am using astral projection to project back to previous lives that I've uncovered through past life regression. I go to the moment of that person's death. I apply Reiki to them. I explain to them that this death is necessary because it's part of a growth process for all the other yous or the other selves that are going to wear different meat suits through time. And so I try to ease their transition so that this lifetime that I'm living right now is more wholesome. With a wholesome. I'm more complete. Mm-hmm. And she looked at me and she's like, oh, I'm going to introduce you to the director. And so I ended up chatting with the director of the Rhine. And, you know, I've been involved with different things, both as a guinea pig, as well as a clinician, you know, tearing through data and doing some data sets for them.
What makes humans special? So reason why I bring this up is, and maybe I'm looking at it from the outside looking in. So we are stuck in our three-dimensional world with the fourth dimension of time keeping us, in our little constraints here. But the Earth...
Well, you're...
What's that?
You're stuck in it.
Oh, yeah, I am. I absolutely am, right? I would love not to be, but I'm still working on that. So, Earth has been here for, I think, 4.5 billion years. And then life came up about 1 billion years after the Earth came. So we'll say 3.5 billion years ago. And then, you know, from then it took like 2 billion years for us to even have multicellular organisms. And then another 0.5 billion years for those organisms to come out of the ground, and then 400 million years for them to, you know, turn into dinosaurs, and then and through all this, a bunch of mass extinctions. So basically, for every, if you consider the small single cell organisms, you know, how many different kinds there were, and so many that we didn't even know about, you could probably safely say that 99.99% of any species that's lived is no longer living right now. So we're humans are, I mean, even if you just take humans, I mean, we're probably 0.001% of these things that ever lived. I mean, look at all the hominids, look at all the things that looked like humans, Neanderthals, Australopithecus. Anyways, all these different, the caveman. Yeah, I'm not even going to try to pronounce any of this stuff. But what is it about humans that we were gifted with this ability? See, this is where it's hard for me to separate the physical from the metaphysical. Because in my head, I would say, you know, these experiences are interesting, but it could be an evolutionary mechanism to, you know, to have a near-death experience to, you know, I don't know. It would have some sort of evolutionary reason to it.
I want to hear if John is going to say what I'm thinking. John, what do you think about that? What makes humans special, considering that we're only like 0.001% of the life forms on this planet?
And we're only here for the last second of the year. You know what I mean? Like, if you look at the existence of Earth on a year, mm-hmm. we're here at like, I think we're like 10 minutes to midnight or something. It's not, you know, we haven't been here that long, but thoughts, John.
Your reality and my reality are very different. But to answer using your reality, yeah. I would say that you are making the mistake of egocentrism.
Okay.
Because I don't think humans are unique in the consciousness realm. I think that there are other things on this planet that have consciousness, but we do not yet have the ability to recognize it.
Like other things like whales?
This is John's way of saying all dogs go to heaven.
That might be it. There's actually a book out there. I can't remember the guy's name, but I think the name of the book is What Do Dogs Know? And they talk about how does your dog know when you're coming home? And one of the experiments they do is they actually had owners think of a toy and the dog would go get the toy.
So then
the question is the human projecting and the dog receiving, or is this a thing where maybe the dog can look into the future and the dog precognizance knows that, oh, you're going to think of that thing, so I'm going to go get it. There's no way to prove that, but there are some experiments going on where they're, you know, putting dogs in MRIs and doing tests. And like one of the things they know is that if a dog sees the owner's face, there's this huge release of oxytocin. Mm-hmm. So just a dog seeing your face makes a dog happy.
Mm-hmm. That's why I love dogs. Dogs are great.
That's why everyone loves dogs.
That's right.
No, but I think I would have said the same thing. That's what I was thinking when you were talking about how it doesn't make sense that we would be the only ones. But there's no reason for us to think that we are the only ones who have these amazing experiences.
Yeah. I don't see dolphins using laptops, though.
That's true, but I don't know that that has anything to do with
consciousness.
Yeah.
Right.
They probably, perhaps they look at us and they think, oh man, humans are missing out on all this.
So John, are you saying that in the afterlife, and we'll just use dolphins as the example, my place in the afterlife would be akin to, or meaning no greater than, say a dolphin's or a dog's, like we're equal creatures in another realm. So it's basically it's not harps and the guy with the big beard. It's almost a return to energy or a return to, I don't even know. How am I going to put my words to it if I don't even know what I'm talking about?
If I was 15 years old, I have no business being in a Porsche 911. My parents got me a 1975 Ford LTD that was like 16 years old. So that was my first car, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. Because I was driving by Braille and trying to catch air over railroad tracks and all sorts of crazy, stupid things.
Yeah.
So if your consciousness is independent of your physical, corporeal self, and you try to step into something you're not ready for, then maybe you need to step into something you are ready for. So your consciousness may say, let me be a tree. okay, now that I know what that's like, let me be a bird. Okay, I know what that's like. And so you progress to more and more complicated things as your consciousness is able to accommodate things. And so now you're at this point of, okay, I'm in this meat suit that everyone recognizes as Kevin. I need to play out that role and do those things that my consciousness says that I can do now with this meat suit, with the five sensory apparatus that go along with it. At some point in time, you're going to shuffle off that mortal coil. You're going to, go through those lessons. Okay, what did I do well? What did I not do well? What can I go back and do again? And it's kind of like a video game, some sort of upgrade achieved. And then you advance into something else, which may or may not be human and which may or may not be on this planet.
Do you ever get demoted? I mean, could I come back as... Because I said all this during this podcast, I'm going to come back as like a, I don't know.
Roach.
A roach, no. Who knows, though? Maybe roaches have some pretty cool discussions.
Free will, baby.
Yeah.
My opinion is that, again, it's like a video game. It's like you play a video game and you get through a certain level. Do you keep playing to the next harder level, or do you go back and say, I can replay that one again and get a better score? You do both, right?
Mm-hmm. I've always been bad at video games, so I used to get the cheat codes.
Okay. All right.
So does that kind of reveal who I am? No, I'm not a cheater. But no, I understand. Sure, I understand what you're saying. And I mean, it makes complete sense. It's just a, just like my journey of learning about different religions and stuff. It does take a bit of a leap of faith. Mm-hmm. And then I think a little bit of personal experience.
That's one of the things that has really still got me befuddled when, I mean, I'm almost 10 years past my near-death experience, and there are still some things that are like mental chew bones, and I just got to chew on it for a while, and then I'll leave and come back to it. But if God, I think that pretty much every religion recognizes God is true love, is the ultimate love and ultimate acceptance. There's no, it's unconditional love, mm-hmm. which means there are no conditions. Mm-hmm. So Mother Teresa and Gandhi are loved just as much as Hitler and Mussolini. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have problems wrapping their brains around that. But it's like, if God is unconditional love, then it doesn't matter what team I play for.
Right.
If I'm a Catholic, if I'm a Buddhist, if I'm an agnostic, if, whatever.
Sure.
It doesn't matter.
I wholeheartedly agree with that. Just having discussions with folks around here, in my neighborhood about religion and stuff, I wholeheartedly believe that, I may not adhere strictly to the, Catholic canon, but, I feel actually, you know what, you're right about that too. Even if you do something that our society would deem as evil, and it very well may be evil, it's still something that you're doing well in this meat suit, you know what I mean? And in this realm for which you exist at this point in time, and that maybe you need to be tweaked a little bit. And it's not, I don't know. My brain's exploding right now.
Well, I've given some talks. When I got out of my near-death experience, one of the things I did is I wanted to figure out, did I break my brain? Mm-hmm. And so I went to a group here in, they share space with the Rhine. It's the International Association of Near-Death Studies, or IONS. And I went to them and I said, hey, I've got a unique situation. Not only am I a near-death experiencer, but I've been doing clinical trials for, about 10, 15 years. Do you have any data that I could look at or anything that I can help you with that will also help me? And it just so happened that they had questionnaires that they had about 200 questionnaires that had been untouched from near-death survivors. Hmm. And I was like, oh, give that to me. I'll put the tables and spreadsheets. But it was also a way for me to see that I wasn't alone in coming back and realizing that I didn't come back with a grand message. I didn't come back with marching orders. And that's where I know that about half the people come back don't. It's where I know about 80% of the people, they find the systems that supported them no longer support them. And that's why people also have PTSD. They have this extraordinary experience. They come back to an environment where that experience doesn't exist. And then you try to share that experience. And there's no corollary in the belief system. So then you find that, well, you can't talk about it at work. You can't talk about it to your pastor. You can't talk about it to your spouse or friends. And so you end up either shutting down or you end up changing the system. If the system doesn't serve you, then you create a new system.
Well, we got a lot to chew on. our time is running out here. But can we have you on again? Because there is, absolutely. I got pages and pages of more stuff that I need to ask you. And
absolutely.
And being we a one man.
Didn't get into the part where, I don't know, do you know Dr. Moody, who did Life Beyond Life?
No, but I remember reading about that. Yeah, it was like the first near-death book that kind of woke people up to that idea.
Yeah. Yeah, so he and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross came out with their books in the same year, which I thought was kind of interesting. But Dr. Moody and I have had several opportunities to talk, and one of the things I blew his mind about was I was talking about astral projecting off-world and the different entities I've met out there. And so when you talk about your reality and my reality of, you know, how come humans are unique? Mm-hmm. My perspective is not only are we not unique, but Earth is kind of a petri dish and we're just the latest iteration. There have been several humans and there's a duck blind that's called the moon. And there's several entities up there that are tinkering with the petri dish. And it's not just me seeing this, but I can go all the way back to Edwin Swedenborg. Yeah. It's one of those 17th, 18th century guys that, you know, farted science, you know. But he talks about astral projection and going off world and talking to these other entities. And when I shared that with Moody, Moody says, you know what, I do that too, but I figured that was too much to share with people.
The moon itself, I mean, I could have a whole podcast just on that, reading up on some of the things that people, theories on the moon and how it's just really a miraculous thing. You know, we just look at it as a rock up there, but it's like no other rock in the known universe, at least that we can see. And, you know,
have you heard the term Dyson sphere?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds
The moon is a Dyson sphere. It's basically an outpost. There's a reason why when the astronauts go and come back, they're very different people. Just if you have a chance, Google or look up the video of when the astronauts came back. Look at Neil Armstrong. Look at those gentlemen's faces.
Yeah.
They just completed the apex of 10, 15 years of their experience, mm-hmm. and education. They should be elated.
Yeah.
And they look like they've been kicked in the nuts.
I'm going to have to check it out. What was it called again?
A Dyson sphere?
No, the thing on YouTube. Or you just look at when they returned. I thought that was the title of it.
No, look at when they returned. But there's a book out there, and I can't remember the name of it, but there is a thing that happens to astronauts when they come back, and they see the world not only as the blue marble, but there's something more going on there. If you look up astronauts and ETs...
I understand now, right.
Then you'll see the astronauts who are coming back, and they've got a message, and as soon as they let that message out, then you find out they're no longer astronauts, and then they go on to teaching or something else.
They say just for a human to look back on the Earth is such a mind well, it totally challenges everything that your brain is meant to understand, to be looking at the Earth, and that alone can really screw people up.
Well, I think an interesting book is The Naked Ape by Desmond Morris.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't read it yet, though.
Yeah, We Don't Belong Here.
I'm going to have to check that one out. I got too much reading I got to do now.
Yeah.
All right. Well, John, the website is alchemistair.com. And I found that, you know, I went there and I could find all your other links and everything like that. And it's also the book that you can find on YouTube. I'll put links and everything on my website, waitwhatif.com. But yeah, we definitely, I'll keep in touch via email so we can kind of hone in some further discussions. But yeah, this stuff's interesting. And we definitely want to have you back on. Where can people, besides your website there, are you on Twitter, or where can other people find you?
Right now, you can find me, well, the book is alchemistsair.com. Mm-hmm. I also have a skin cream company that I make skin creams for people in cancer recovery.
Oh.
And that's elementalchemy.org.
Okay.
And I'm also writing another book right now, which is basically a summation of all the mental rabbit holes I've been spelunking.
Cool. When are you expecting to drop that?
Probably this year. I'm about 180 pages into a 250-page book.
Okay. So you're cranking along there.
Yep.
All right, John. Well, I'm going to have this podcast out on Friday. I just got to do a little bit of editing here and there, get some ads in and some music and stuff. But yeah, we'll have it up on Friday, and then we'll definitely keep in touch. I should have known that we would not be able to cover everything. And let's see, right now we're at an hour and 20 minutes. So yeah, we'll make this a multi-part series. But I thank you very much for your time.
No problem. It's been a pleasure. I don't get to explore too often. So I appreciate the time and the ability to do that.
Absolutely. Thank you, John. You take care.
Thank you. It's been good talking to you.
Thanks, Evan. Hi. Bye-bye. Bye.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast. And at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.